Well, it is a pleasure to be here inside, not out at the soccer field where there was a lot of rain. But and my family's not here today. I wish they were, because they would love to see some of their teammates in soccer. But they're at family in Southern Illinois, so I've been at home eating junk food and trying to get projects done. But we live in Millersville, so we're just down the road, and we've been at Manor Church. I was on staff there for about 6 years, from 2006 till 2011, and then we were in Bangladesh for 3 years, and we've been back kind of transitioning. And the idea is to be in London, where there's a pretty big population of South Asians, believe it or not, the second most in London outside of the country that we were serving in Bangladesh. But I will never forget the first time that I traveled to South Asia. I was with the pastor, John Hallbaker, at Manor that I was working with. And as we got on the airplane, it's like a 16-hour flight from Newark directly to Delhi. And I'll never forget, as the plane was descending, I experienced India while I was still in the plane. As the air came through the vents, I immediately thought, this is not New York. This is not Lancaster smell. This is the smell of dust and of animals and of people. I mean, it just, I can't get it out of my mind. And as the plane got below the smog, I just looked out and there were houses and buildings everywhere, like as far as you could see. And as I walked out of that terminal, just the sound, the cacophony of different voices in Hindi, of tribal languages, and I knew none of it. And as somebody who hadn't traveled much, I was feeling really uncomfortable, really awkward. I mean, I was with a fellow pastor that I knew, but still it wasn't enough, because we were two people among these masses. And as I looked out, I was trying to find a face, the face of Ken Hoke. I had heard about Ken before, and I knew that he was going to be our host in the country, but I didn't know what he looked like. I just knew that his face was whiter than the other brown faces. And eventually I spotted him, and I was so excited to see him. I actually gave him a hug. It was the first time I met him, but I still hugged him. And just that feeling of being outside of what was normal and finding somebody who is a friend, somebody who knew the language, who was able to get us into a taxi cab because he spoke Hindi, who was able to get me a SIM card for my phone so I could call my wife. That feeling as an outsider, to know somebody who's on the inside, who can help you, there's a peace that comes from that. And it was probably a year after I returned from that trip to South Asia that I found out that there were South Asians coming to the U.S. as refugees. And so my wife and our young adult group at Manor, we said, you know, I've experienced what it's like to be an outsider on my trip. I wonder what it would be like if we as a collective group could welcome these refugees. And so we did. So we partnered with this organization, Church World Services, and there were two young girls. They were, I believe, 20 years old, traveling here with no family. They only had a bag that was as big as like a shopping sack from Giant. That was all that they had to bring to the States. We picked them up from the airport and we helped them figure out what it meant to get a TB test at the hospital, what it meant in the US to shop for groceries. They'd never been to a supermarket before. They'd never used an ATM or had a bank account before. And so we, knowing that world, were able to help them come alongside them, because I had felt what it was like to be an outsider. And now, as a person who's comfortable with Lancaster County, was able to help and come alongside them. And I can only imagine that each of us, we felt what it's like to be an outsider. We felt what it's like to be comfortable. And we're going to have experiences throughout our life of being on the inside, being on the outside. And there is something, no matter what culture we're in, that there's a sense of hospitality, that is, being a guest, being on the outside or being on the inside, and the connection between those two, we call that hospitality. And every culture, whether you're in Asia or in the US, has a way of doing that. And that's true of the kingdom of God as well. There is a way to practice hospitality that is kingdom of God, and it's different than our world cycle. And we're going to take a look at that this morning. I would encourage you to turn to Luke 14. I'm a bit old-fashioned, so I think it would be great if you could turn in a Bible and find it. It's page 1621 in the copy of the scriptures with you in your pew there. The story that we find is in the gospel, so it's the story about Jesus, and we find ourselves in the midst of a story where Jesus is hanging out with some Pharisees. Now, Pharisees were that group that your average Joe would have looked up to. So the religious sect that cared about following the laws in the most concrete ways that they could. And they wanted to do a good job at that. And so they had actually come up with a whole bunch of restrictions so that they could do and practice the law in the way that they felt was most accurate. And on the Sabbath day, the equivalent to like our Sunday, would have been a day that had all kinds of restrictions. So probably more restrictions than any other day. And that was the day that Jesus was invited to the home of a prominent Pharisee. And that's where we find him this morning is our text begins. So this is Luke chapter 14, beginning in verse 1. One Sabbath, when Jesus went to eat in the house of a prominent Pharisee, he was being carefully watched. There in front of him was a man suffering from dropsy, or an abnormal swelling of his body. Jesus asked the Pharisee and the experts in the law, "Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath or not?" But they remained silent. So taking hold of the man, he healed him and sent him on his way. So here's Jesus. He's shown up at this house of this Pharisee who's a big deal, who's looked up to by everyone in that community, and he's probably still standing up in the doorway or just inside the home, and there's somebody who shouldn't be there that is. There's a man who's got swelling on his body. Dropsy is just a general term for some time of swelling that shouldn't be there. And he's in the midst of this group of Pharisees. Now, I say he shouldn't be there because in that culture, when you have a medical condition that's external like that, you should be ostracized from the community, like nowhere around, because it's not just seen as an infectious disease that could be contagious, but it's actually the kind of deal that would be presumed to have a moral connection to it. So he would have been assumed to have had some kind of moral failing in his past, or maybe his parents, that he contracted this disease. And so he would have been the outside of the community, would not have been able to go to the temple, and certainly would not have been somebody that the Pharisees would have wanted close to them, because they knew the law that they couldn't associate or touch or be anywhere close to somebody with a disease like this. So the simple fact that he's at this meal is ridiculous, and it's crazy, and it has all the signs of being a setup, right? That somebody set this man there to force Jesus into doing something. And so Jesus does something which is completely bizarre. Jesus sees this man, and it says he takes hold of him, which means he embraces him, he touches him, he breaks Jewish law in order to embrace him, and by doing so, he heals him. Now, this is amazing on a couple counts, because A, like I said, he breaks the law, he breaks tradition. Why? Because here's a man who for his entire life, most likely, or ever since he contracted this condition, has had the perception that he is not spiritual enough, that he is not acceptable enough to God to come close. And so Jesus, God himself, wraps his arms around this man, shows him that he is loved and accepted, and heals him. And I don't know which would have stuck more with this man in the future after he left, that he's healed of this illness, or that this man Jesus, who he'd most likely heard about, had embraced him. Who knows when the last time he had been touched by human hands and he felt the hug of Jesus. And I think it's important at this point in the story to just pause and say, for each of us, do we realize that is the relationship that we have with Jesus? That no matter what our week has been like this week, if we felt like we've completely blown it, if we felt like the kind of rug went out, we felt like we were trying to do everything right and just things didn't work out. If we've been trying to help somebody and we feel like everything we've tried to do just hasn't been enough. The reality this morning is that Jesus wants to step close to us, not because we're acceptable or we've done things right, or we've done the law to the T, but no matter what we're like, where we're at, He wants to embrace us with his arms. And it's that embrace, it's Jesus' willingness to step toward us and embrace us. That's what makes us acceptable and clean and whole. That's good news. And that's where it starts this morning. You know, as Jesus is there after he's sent this man, you know, out walking, the men in the home, because it would have just been men, they would have started to find their seats, right? They would have started to look for at the table their chairs. Now, they wouldn't have been chairs, actually. Probably would have been cushions. And as that kind of dance was happening, as people were milling around, finding their places, Jesus sees the way that that's happening and sees people looking for the places of honor, and he starts to tell a story. Look at this. In verse 7, when he noticed the guests pick the places of honor at the table, he told them this parable. Now, he tells them this parable, but it's a really... he tells them a story about a wedding feast, but it's really similar to just any normal meal, and it's Jesus' kind of sarcasm. Now, you'll see here as we move through this progression of stories that Jesus' way of talking is an Eastern way of talking. So you want to protect somebody's honor, and you want to tell them that they're doing something that's not quite right, but instead of just coming directly out and saying, hey, don't just look for the places of honor. Come on, guys, really? He says, hey, consider this story of a wedding. You know how at a wedding, when people try and find a seat for the wedding, they look around and they know what the best seat is. It's the seat that's the closest to the person who's getting married. And so when you go to a wedding, don't just look for the best seat. Because what's going to happen? If you put yourself in the best seat, somebody that's a bigger deal than you is going to come by. And the host is going to say, you know what? You need to move down the line. And that's going to be awkward and embarrassing. So instead, what you should do, Jesus says, hypothetically, you should find the worst seat and you should sit there, because then what could happen is that the host could say, hey, you know what? Actually, I want you up here closer to me, and then you'll be honored. And so as he's telling this parable, you can just imagine the Pharisees are taking notice, right? Because they want to have that best seat. And they're like, oh, that's interesting. Take the worst seat and then I'll get the best seat. And even when Jesus sort of paraphrases it at the end and he says, if you humble yourself, you'll be exalted. If you exalt yourself, you'll be humbled. You can even imagine the wheels in their brain thinking, well, you know, I've humbled myself by taking on all of these extra responsibilities of the law. I've made myself humble by not walking more than just a few paces on the Sabbath and doing everything just right. Normal people, they break the law, they do all that stuff because they're proud and arrogant, but I'm humble, I do this right, so I'm going to be exalted surely, right? And so they're thinking about it this way, taking notes, and Jesus continues in an even more direct way. So first he talked in a parable, right? Now Jesus is going to bring it looking squarely at the host of this party, that through this party for Jesus, he looks squarely at him. In verse 12, he says this, then Jesus to the host, to the man who most likely was the one who brought this fellow who had the swelling on his body into the midst of this. Jesus looks directly at him and he says, when you give a luncheon or a dinner, forget the fact that we're actually having a luncheon or a dinner right now. But when you do, don't invite your friends, your brothers or your sisters, your relatives or your rich neighbors. If you do, they may invite you back, and so you'll be repaid. But when you give a banquet, invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, and the blind, and you will be blessed. Although they cannot repay you, you will be repaid at the resurrection of the righteous. This is rough. I mean, this is pretty rough. This is Jesus talking right at you. And it turns everything upside down, right? I mean, I'm not much different from the Pharisees that are here, and many of us aren't either. We understand the social constructs of our world, right? The social ladder, where in order to get ahead, you help the right people, and then maybe at the right time, those people will help you. And that's how you move up, right, in society. That's how you get to a place that the world calls good. And yet the kingdom of God is different. It's upside down. It's backwards. And Jesus knows that. You know, the biggest party that I threw was my wedding reception. And I don't know if any of you did this when you had your wedding, but you invite certain people to your wedding because you know they're actually not going to come, but they might give you a good gift. And so it's worth it to have them on the wedding list, right? And so you kind of pad things that way. And that's just our culture. And I'm not saying that's bad. But I'm just saying that this is so infused in the way that we operate that sometimes we forget about it. And what Jesus is saying here is that when we live, when we operate, we need to make space for people that are on the outsides. Because what happens is over time, we tend to isolate ourselves into communities that, if we can afford it, are gated. If we can afford it, have bigger fences. If we can afford it, our air conditioner, climate control, so that we can stay inside our home, inside our zone, only invite people in who we want to be in and keep out those who we'd rather not. And that's not kingdom hospitality. The different way that Jesus talks about here pushes at those of us who have made ourselves comfortable, myself included. I mean, this is awkward for me. One of my favorite Bible scholars, N.T. Wright, when he was asked, what do you learn about Jesus? You read the Bible in Greek, for crying out loud, every day for your devotions. Like, how does Jesus become fresh to you? And he said, Jesus is more uncomfortable to me every time I read the Gospels. And this is somebody who knows Jesus more than anybody practically that I know. And this is uncomfortable to me. And yet what I find here is that Jesus saying, if our faith has become cold, If our faith has become religious and sort of compartmentalized, one of the suggestions here is to find communities of people who are marginalized, who are broken, who actually need God to show up, or they're hurting. There's a disability community gathering that happens at Manor that my wife and I and our kids love to go to, and it's probably one of the most fun worship services I can imagine. Those who have disabilities are leading, and it's kind of a chaotic mess, but it's awesome, and it's beautiful. And what would it look like if you came alongside somebody who's in the hospital, who's struggling and needs God to show up, and maybe you don't have the right words, and you just sit there with them and are present with them? What would happen if you found yourself spending time with a mom who's got kids and they're kind of out of control, and it might feel out of control for you to be with them, but just to place yourself in a situation where you just need more of God? Because that's what happens when we find ourselves close to the broken, close to those who are hopeless, is we need God to show up. And it's in that place that we find God becoming good news to us. And yet the story continues here. it's awkward already, and you would think by this point that those who are gathered are sort of getting the point, and yet the reality is they're not, because they're somewhat similar to me and probably some of us, that it takes a long time for the truth to get in. But there's this guy here, and I can just imagine Jesus sort of rolling his eyes, which Jesus does tend at some points to be a little sarcastic. But they're sitting around the table, and in verse 15, it says, when one of those at the table who had heard him say this, that's tell these sequence of parables and call the guy out who brought this man into the mix, this man said to Jesus, blessed is the one who will eat at the feast in the kingdom of God. Now, that sounds kind of like nice words, but the reality is they were like insider religious language that this guy is kind of tossing up to get the awkwardness to move on. It's kind of like the equivalent in the midst of an awkward dinner party where somebody says, well, how about the Phillies this year? You know, how are they looking? Or, yeah, you know, I hear it's going to rain tomorrow, maybe, or I don't know. What do you think? It's kind of breaking the ice, that sort of thing. And this guy tosses up this religious language, and Jesus doesn't take the bait. Instead, he drills in even more specific, and I feel bad for this poor fella in a way. But Jesus continues, and he says this. Look at verse 16. Jesus replied, "A certain man was preparing a great banquet and invited many guests. At the time of the banquet, he sent his servant to tell those who had been invited, 'Come, for everything is now ready.' But they, all alike, began to make excuses. The first said, 'I've just bought a field, and I must go and see it. Please excuse me.' Another said, 'I've just bought 5 yoke of oxen, and I'm on my way to try them out. Please excuse me.' Still another said, 'I've just got married, so I can't come.' Enough said. The servant came back and reported this to his master. Then the owner of the house became angry and ordered his servant, 'Go out quickly into the streets and alleys and bring in the poor, the crippled, the blind, and the lame.' 'Sir,' the master said, 'what you ordered has been done, but there is still room.' Then the master told his servant, 'Go out to the roads, country lanes, and compel them to come in so that my house will be full. I tell you, not one of those who are invited will get a taste of my banquet.'" The banquet here is a euphemism for the kingdom of God. It's that community of people who know God, not only someday in heaven when the world is all remade new, but also in this life, what that community of God looks like. And it's a community that looks different. And Jesus has been talking about describing what this community is going to look at. He's been inviting people in that might not be familiar to that religious community back then. He's been in welcoming people that are broken. He's been healing those whose eyes are blind. He's been people who are possessed by demons. He's been pushing those demons out, freeing them. Jesus has been welcoming all sorts of those in the outcasts in. And there have been some people who have been really frustrated by that, right? The Pharisees, those here in this story who he's told him consecutive times, guys, the religious piece, that's not the point. The point is to come close enough to God so that he can welcome you in, not on your merits, but on God's willingness to save. And yet here in this story, he's saying it's not enough just to be invited, right? Because that invitation has been open to the Pharisees. The guy who he singled out, that man, the host of this awkward dinner party, is welcome into the kingdom. That invitation has been extended. It's also welcome to the man who had been rejected by the religious community. His body was swollen and Jesus embraced and healed. And yet the invitation alone is not enough. And that's the point of this last parable, right? Jesus sent out this invitation, but people made excuses. And we do the same thing, don't we? Like, I've got young kids. Life is crazy. So you know what? I'm just going to kind of hunker down, do the kid thing. Maybe we'll get involved, you know, with other people when I've got enough energy. But right now, like, I'm tapped out. We say, you know what? I'm broken. I'm jacked up. Like, I'm not like my older brother who's got it all together. I've got issues. Like, I'm just going to stay at kind of arm's length until I figure my stuff out, and then I'll reconnect with God once I'm sort of cleaned up and better. And what Jesus is saying here is, guys, the excuse is, forget about that. I don't want you cleaned up. I don't need you to have energy and have things solved. I want you close now because I'm the one who can clean. I'm the one who can heal. And I want you close. And Jesus is saying, accept my invitation. And the reality is that when we accept his invitation to be a part of this kingdom, this community, both here and in the world to come, we're going to be a part of a group of people who were addicted and found healing and restoration because of Christ coming close. We're going to be a part of a community who have felt the effects of sickness, and yet those same people will have felt the healing of Christ, whether in this life or in the life to come. That community that Jesus is talking about here, that great banquet, is a group of people who have felt hopeless, I mean, really in despair. And in that place, have in their brokenness said, God, help. And they felt Jesus' presence with them. This community is a community that's awkward, that's difficult, that's not people who look like us, who smell like us, who speak the same language as us, who have the same economic background maybe. But it's a group of people that we've got one thing in common, that without Jesus, we've got nothing. And yet with him, we felt that embrace, that closeness. And I wonder when the last time it was that you felt that embrace of Christ. Because he wants it to be something that's fresh on our minds, because it's the freshness of that embrace that compels us, that motivates us to reach out. I'll never forget a trip that we took to North Carolina. It was the longest trip, and I remember I was getting kind of tired, so we made a Starbucks stop along the way, and we piled out of the minivan, and as we did, we noticed this couple kind of on the sidewalk there, and they had backpacks on. The one guy had a bunch of dreads, and they had a sign that said to North Carolina, and it was kind of on the ground there. And as I went in to get coffee, I was just looked at it. I was like, huh, they're going to North Carolina. That's interesting. I got a cup of coffee. And as I was getting my coffee, I was like, we're going to North Carolina. Interesting. I wonder, I mean, maybe we could give them a ride. We've got a van that's packed for a week. And this isn't like normal for us. Like, we don't normally pick up hitchhikers. But I talked to Lindsay, and I was like, should we or shouldn't we? She's like, yeah, let's do it. And so we did. We said, hey, do you guys want a ride? And they're like, yeah, sure. And so we pulled out the spare seat from our back and made our 7-passenger minivan an 8-person. And Magpie and Zoe climbed in. And they were sitting right next to Elizabeth, who was 2 at the time. She was in her car seat. And then it was Zoe, the girl, and then Magpie, who is next to her. And as we're driving along, I realized pretty quickly that they probably hadn't had a bath very recently. I mean, they were kind of hippie-ish, and I don't know if it was by choice or just to help the dreads form, but there was something going on. And we took a break a little bit later, and Sam, my son, came up to me and said, hey, Dad, they kind of stink. And I was like, I know, buddy, but we're helping them out, and this is what we do as a family. So do you think you can make it? And he said, yeah, I think so, but if you could crack the window in the back. So I was like, we'll do that. And as we stopped, they took a smoke break, and my kids were still there, and they were hanging out with them. They were doing cartwheels together, and I was kind of proud of them for not saying something like, why are you smoking or something? But I was proud of them in that moment. They're not always that respectful, but they were. And I was grateful for that, because as we got back into the car and we started driving, my daughter, Elizabeth, reached over to Zoe's face and started rubbing her cheek. And as she rubbed her cheek, she said, you're so beautiful. And I couldn't believe it. And I believe my wife, Lindsay, said, hey, Elizabeth, stop, because not everybody really likes their cheek caressed. You're not used to 2-year-olds. So she said, come on, Elizabeth, stop. But Elizabeth didn't stop. She kept doing this and saying, you're so beautiful. And I just can't imagine what it's got to be like for Zoe now. She was traveling. We heard her whole story as we were driving, that she had left her family in California. She's from a very affluent family, but she just wanted to travel. Met this guy, Magpie, who's from the UK, and they were just going from Maine all the way down to Asheville, just traveling. They didn't know what to do with their life. I can't imagine that Zoe won't still remember this 2-year-old little girl rubbing her and saying, you are so beautiful. And it's because Elizabeth, who at 2 has been told probably every day, Elizabeth, you are so beautiful. You are so special to us. That in that moment, when she was seated next to this girl, just out of the overflow of this little 2-year-old's heart, was able, despite the smell, despite the dreads, despite any of that, to see with Christ's eyes and tell and proclaim prophetically to this woman, you are beautiful. And that, I believe, is what the kingdom of God is like. That is what gospel hospitality is like. When we've been filled into by parents, by people who love us, by God's embrace, when we've been filled up, we're able to respond in love to people who desperately need it. As the worship team comes up to lead us in a final song, I'd just like to ask you to remember two things. This week, I would invite you to allow to be present God's embrace, his welcome. If it's been a while, if it's been weeks or months or years that you've actually really felt God being close to you, would you pray and ask him to show up and have a present experience of God's welcome? Because I believe that we cannot welcome others in humility and in sincerity if we're not operating from the grounds that we need his welcome and his love ourselves. And if it's been a while, I would invite you to just start and say, God, show me how much you love me, how much you welcome me. And secondly, after we've become aware of God's welcome to us, I would say, pray and begin this week before you head off to work, whether it's as you're brushing your teeth, whether you're getting your coffee, whether you're driving to work, say, God, lead me to a person today that I can welcome. Somebody who's on the outside that I normally don't talk to or normally wouldn't interact with. Show me a way that I can just give your welcome to that person. Let's sing together as a family.